You might just get a replace.
Got it. Oh, where's my eraser? That's the... Ooh, not erasing. Yeah, you guys can have it. No problem. Okay. Oh, and I've got a bad marker too. Could be because it's what? Toss it. One, the unity of being, transcending all that exists. Two, if one is the source and archetype of unity, two is the beginning of diversity. It represents polarity and division, and also feminine receptivity and fruitfulness. Three, unity and diversity are reconciled in harmony. The triangle that is the geometrical translation of the fundamental musical chord with its three notes is called a triad. Four, quaternity expressed as a square, the first solid number, represents the earth or the entire material plane. For the ancients, the world below the stars was composed of the four elements, earth, water, air, and fire. Earth and fire were opposed to each other, while water and air mediated between them. Arithmetic in the ancient world was not considered to be objective. It was not considered to be purely objective. What did I just say about those numbers? One, unity that is transcendent. Two, represents the feminine quality, unity and plurality. Three, unity and plurality reconciled in harmony. Four, representing the earth. What do I have here, by the way? Does anybody recognize this? The sacred tetractys. What is the sum of the dots that I have here? How many dots do I have, speaking of modeling steps? 10. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, mysteriously and interestingly, adds up to 10. 10. There were 10 commandments given to Moses. The sacred tetractys of the Pythagoreans is the sum of the first four numbers represented by 10 points in an equilateral triangle. 1 over 2 over 3 over 4, the four-lettered name of God equivalent to the Jewish Yahweh, J-H-V-H. Moreover, listen to this from the Pythagoreans. This is Aristotle on the Pythagoreans. A different party in the same school say that the first principles are 10, named according to the following table. Limited and unlimited, even and odd, one and many, right and left, male and female, rest and motion, straight and crooked, light and darkness, good and bad, square and oblong. For the ancients and for the medievals, even arithmetic was not this pure objectivity that we think about it today. There was this kind of sacredness to number, this objectivity mixed with subjectivity. If you read Nicomachus' Introduction to Arithmetic, which I can say there's probably only one of us in this room that has, and it's not me, I think it's Andrew Elizalde over there, you'll see that there's a mystery in the arithmetic of the ancients. As they approach number, yes, you get all the addition, you get all the multiplication, but there is mystery there. Just say yes or no. Yes or no?
Yes.
Who can see the ratio of one side of the string to the other? 1:1. If I were to say the ratio of this portion of the string that I'm playing to the entire string, what is that ratio? 1:2, isn't it? Interesting. Yes or no? Yes or no? Who can see the ratio of the string that I'm playing there? Any guesses? Any observations? 1:3. 1:3. Tell me about this. Did you make the judgment of yes or no before or after you saw the ratio? Before you, after you saw the ratio?
Before.
Tell me, is this idea of music, this Pythagorean idea, is it objective or subjective? How did you make the distinction about the ratio? I mean, you saw the ratio, yes, but how did you make the distinction? How did you know that it was with your ear, right?
It sounded beautiful.
It sounded beautiful, right? Is there beauty in mathematics? The ancients definitely believed so, that there was beauty tied in with mathematics. The arithmetic, not even arithmetic, was considered a purely objective discipline. Clearly the music was this idea of this aesthetic judgment, this aesthetic beauty that was mathematical, that pervaded all of reality, that a mathematical harmony and beauty pervaded all of reality. Interestingly, even Catherine Pickstott, one of the crew of radical orthodoxies at Cambridge, in the crew of radical orthodox believers, says of Augustine, she says that Augustine, while he considered to beauty to have an objectivity, he also considered it to be subjective, because he could look at an ordered whole, but he was looking at this ordered whole not from outside the ordered whole as a critic. He wasn't looking at an infinite that he had no place in, that he was adrift in the sea, like Pascal felt when he said an infinity above us, an infinity below us. But Pascal saw himself as looking at an ordered whole, at a cosmos, as a part to a whole, one part.
You mean Augustine?
I'm sorry. What did I? Yes.
Pascal.
Augustine saw as a part to the ordered whole. He saw himself, and while he recognized there is a subjective ordered whole, he also recognized the inherent subjectivity of himself being a part of this ordered whole. And so Pickstock identifies that when Augustine's writing his treatise on the liberal art of music, that he has both this principle of objectivity and subjectivity held together in tension, that for the ancients and the medievals, mathematics was a discipline that had both the beauty, this aesthetic piece to it, as well as the objective piece to it. We've talked a good bit today already about math and science, and so I don't want to say too much more, but I'll say a couple things. We've talked often about Occam today, and one of the things I will help you enter into a conversation that I used to have with Kevin when I was questioning, well, why is Occam such a boogeyman? And Kevin would say, well, I'd say, well, what about Occam's razor? He introduced that, didn't he? Wasn't that just one of those fantastic things that Occam helped introduce to science? And Kevin would say, oh, that was just a medieval commonplace, that it's better to have simpler things than more complex things. That's just obvious. But I was very fascinated when I actually read a little bit about this in Gilson. And Gilson referred to Occam's razor, the idea that there is preference for simpler things than for more complex things, as an arbitrary preference for unity. He referred to it as an arbitrary preference for unity, that Occam's razor is really just an arbitrary preference for unity. The thing that made me fascinated about that is that's when I realized it's an aesthetic judgment. Occam's razor is an aesthetic judgment. It's a desire to perceive a unity, a beautiful unity at the center of things. It's not necessarily true that what you're considering needs to be represented in one thing. Maybe it's better represented in three things. Maybe it's better represented as four elements than as one atom at the foundation of all reality. Maybe it's better represented as a zoo of particles like we understand reality to be rather than just the atoms. In fact, underneath the atoms is this zoo of particles. The arbitrary preference for unity. But I want you also to understand that Occam's razor is very powerful as an aesthetic judgment. As an aesthetic judgment, it is very powerful to use in math. And we've already talked a good bit today and yesterday about the power of hypotheses and metaphors in science and mathematics. That you, at the very bottom of the quadrivium, I think there are two metaphors, two aesthetic judgments. And I would suggest that we as Christians introduce the third. The two aesthetic judgments are unity or discrete unity or continuous magnitude. Discrete or continuous magnitude. And I would like to suggest that we introduce the third as a continuous concept that we muse on, the Trinity. The Trinity as something that we behold of beauty. And what we've talked about today, I think Steve has talked eloquently about the perichoretic love among the Trinity and how that perichoretic love is a beautiful picture of kenosis and pouring out, and that as much as the arbitrary preference for unity or the arbitrary preference for plurality, the picture of God's interrelationality, the one, the three, and the many, I think is even a more beautiful picture, a more comely and attractive picture for us to behold. Let me read you a quote about this. Sometimes the idea of the Trinity is modeled after the idea of harmony that the ancients had, but I think the Trinity is even more robust than harmony. But of beauty and harmony in science and mathematics, let me read you this quote that Einstein wrote about Planck. Max Planck was the founder of quantum physics, and Einstein says of Planck, "The longing to behold harmony is the source of the inexhaustible patience and perseverance with which Planck has devoted himself to the most general problems of our science. Refusing to let himself be diverted to more grateful and more easily obtained ends, listen to this, the state of mind which enables a man to do work of this kind is akin to that of the religious worshiper or the lover. The effort comes straight from the heart." Hear that eros that Steve was talking about earlier today. What is it that's drawing him? The harmony. The longing to behold harmony, the beauty drawing him to the truth, the beauty drawing him to the truth. Beauty for truth's sake. Beauty for truth's sake. So. In fact, I was going to be happy to give Grant some grace, but I was afraid to cross you, Chris, to be honest.
Well, we'll be tomorrow morning at what is the time for that? 8:45 for our final session. So let's stand up and have a prayer, and we can enjoy some time together. Yeah.